Mary's In and Out of Sect podcast, a show about the sun and how astrologers embody and relate to it. My name is SB Hall, and I'm your host. In today's episode on the Sagittarius sun as a luminary out of sect, I speak with the astrologer and comedian, Fand Cleary. I'm really excited to be dropping the third episode of my new sun series, which will continue for the next year. For new listeners, please go back and listen to the moon series that I've been doing over the last year where I speak to different astrologers about their moon sign. It was awesome to chat with Fionn about his chart and astrological practice. This past weekend, he launched his astrology website, so please be sure to check that out in the show notes. In addition, I was honored to guest on Mackenzie McCormick's podcast, Funk with Fate, to talk about my experience having Mars in Sagittarius in my birth chart, along with my wonderful co-guest, Key, who is Godspeed Earthlings on Instagram. It was a really beautiful conversation where I got quite vulnerable about my personal journey and my personal experience of my chart. So I do hope everyone listens to it and gets something out of it. That episode will be released on Mars Day, December 5th. So that's Tuesday, December 5th. So check it out if you have a chance. As always, if you enjoy the work that I'm doing on this podcast, please contribute to its sustainability by becoming a supporting member or offering a one-time donation on my website. There you can also find information on my services. I'm currently offering natal and timing consultations, as well as answering horary questions. Hope you enjoy the conversation. All right, Fionn Cleary, thank you so much for being with me here today. How are you doing?
Yeah, good. Thank you for having me. Was a little bit sleepy during the day, but trying to wake up my buoyant Sagittarian optimism to be somewhat entertaining for this podcast. So yeah, thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. For those listening and watching, it's November 30th at 5:10 p.m. Eastern time. You are Greenwich Mean Time, is that GMT?
Where yeah, so it's just gone 10 past 10 over here.
Cool. Awesome. We're doing a late night recording for you, but I really appreciate you being here. I was looking at your chart earlier today, and it looks like some of the recent astrology played into your natal chart. So I'm just curious to hear how have things been for you lately astrologically?
Yeah, so those recent eclipses were very personal. That last eclipse in Libra happened very close to my ascendant. And I think that that might be one of those cases where something started emerging at that time that I'm not wholly consciously aware of, because luckily it wasn't one of those eclipses where it was like very obvious and very dramatic. Mm-hmm. So I think looking back in my biography, I'm going to know what that is. Mm-hmm. Not super clear about what that eclipse was, but yeah, on a personal level, that eclipse was very chill. On a worldwide level, not so much.
Not so chill. Yeah, absolutely. And as a Libra rising, do you feel like you experience all of the Venus retrogrades with equal intensity? And I ask because I personally experience the Leo retrograde pretty intensely every 8 years that it happens. And I know that we have, I believe, opposite nodes. Like you have the North Node in Leo, and I have the South Node in Leo. And I also have Venus in Aquarius. And so those are two maybe personal reasons for me why those retrogrades are most intense. But how is that retrograde for you? And how do you experience Venus retrograde in general? Is it always the same or does some hit harder?
So luckily, Venus retrogrades have not been as intense as other retrogrades. Mars retrogrades historically, maybe because it's in my first, have been super noticeable. But Venus retrogrades are chill enough. I did have some like relational stuff right as it stationed retrograde, but Venus going retrograde in my 11th house really manifested as me becoming more public facing, trying to sell a one-man show for an entire month.
Congratulations on that, by the way. How did that go?
Yeah, that went great. So I did a show in September called Chiron, a One Centaur Show. And I think we can talk a lot about that. And this episode is Chiron is really tied into the star lore of Sagittarius. So I think there is lots to get into when discussing that myth and how it ties into some of the significations or the lore behind Sag.
Wonderful. Awesome. Yeah. And for those who are listening and not watching, I just pulled up Fionn's chart and Mars is at 9 degrees of Libra and his ascendant is at 20 degrees of Libra. So Mars is in the first whole sign house. It's interesting that you mention the Mars retrogrades because I think I feel I have the moon and Mars in my first. And I definitely felt the Mars retrograde when it was retrograde in Gemini last year, was it? I'm like, what year are we in now? But I feel like I feel the eclipses pretty intensely as well with the moon in my first. And so yeah, I'm just curious to hear like how you feel like planets in the first kind of play out, you know, given the fact that you said that retrograde was the Mars retrogrades are intense for you.
Yeah, I think when you have planets in the first, whatever houses they rule, they take on greater significance. So for me, it's definitely relationships. Of course, as a Libra rising, relationships become very important, and like you really define who you are based on how you relate to other people and the kind of bonds you forge. But yeah, definitely, I won't get into it, but I had just this really intense relationship situation at the end of 2020 that occurred exactly for the duration of the retrograde, and it ended right as Mars left Aries. And I got into astrology shortly after that. Actually discovered astrology when I was in that entanglement, so that was also interesting. But yeah, it's interesting to observe just how spot on retrogrades can be, that story began and ended with the retrograde.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, thank you for sharing that. I'm just always curious to hear people's experience. That's, I feel like, why I started this podcast, why I continue to kind of talk to people on the podcast, because astrology is such a personal thing, you know, and I want to hear about people's experience in relation to their chart. So I appreciate you sharing that. Let me stop screen share real quick. So yeah, Fionn, can you give us a introduction to yourself and your astrological practice? Anything that you want, you know, listeners or viewers to know about yourself?
Yeah, so a little bit about me. I'm a comedian, I'm a writer, performer, I do a little bit of stand-up, and I'm also an astrologer, among all those things that really are quite contradictory. But yeah, so yeah, then I guess I've been doing comedy for about 5 years, doing astrology for about three. So yeah, those are my main things.
Very cool. And so, yeah, what do you feel like got you into astrology? If it's not too personal a question, I know that you just kind of spoke about it in relation to this relationship entanglement. But like, what was the thing that sparked your interest in that?
Yeah, so the year before I got into astrology, I got really into tarot and had some dabbling in things like chaos magic, very small forays into stuff like sigil making, never really went down the magic rabbit hole too much. Played around with talismanic materia and stuff like that, but never fell down that rabbit hole as much as I have with astrology.
Very cool. Super interesting. So like you just kind of got into the occult in general, or what have you, and astrology was just a part of that kind of you got hooked
Yeah.
into for whatever reason.
Yeah, I think my interest in the occult definitely started when I was around 18 or 19, and I got really into like a mostly academic study of psychedelics, just started buying all these books, like one or two actual hands-on experiences. But yeah, then that's just opened this gateway of inquiry into all these other subjects, which are kind of weird or taboo in some way. And yeah, then it just naturally led me to astrology, which was this thing I had poo-pooed and dismissed for so long. Oh, I think that dismissal of a lot of this spiritual or alternative stuff came from growing up with a very new agey parent. And I was like, that's your thing. And therefore, it's something I need to be in opposition to. So I'm going to dismiss this entirely. And now, I'm obviously getting into that in my own way.
Yeah, I think that we talk a lot in astrological circles about like the Uranus opposition. I don't know that we talk as much about like teen rebellion, like tying something to, we talk about the Uranus opposition and the midlife crisis, but I'm like, what exactly is going on with like teen rebellion? Because it is really interesting that like oftentimes it is very common to hear that if a parent is into something around the teen years, no matter what it is, the child is attempting to individuate and differentiate from their parent, so they kind of want to do the opposite thing. I'm not exactly sure what that is astrologically, but
Well, when I got into astrology, I was having my Uranus square, and my moon is square Uranus, so I was also having a moon Uranus opposition.
Oh yeah, there's a tight square there. That's really interesting.
I was having all the really like important life astrology at that time. I was having like Pluto right on my IC, having my closing Saturn square, and that was all in 2020, having eclipses in the fourth and the tenth, and the moon was a perfected ruler. So yeah, 2020, while being like a really significant year for everybody, it's just all the life stuff happened in that year. And it was also the tail end of that year I found astrology. So yeah, it was a very, very informative year.
Cool. Yeah, so you spoke about you just talked about being suspicious or rejecting kind of generally new age things because of you had a parent that was kind of into that. And I'm just curious, again for listeners, Fionn has the sun under the horizon, so a night chart. And so I know for myself as a night chart, I didn't always identify with my sun sign. And so I was like, not exactly suspicious. I also think like I'm a Capricorn sun, and like I think Capricorns get a lot of hate generally. Maybe all people do feel that about their sun sign. Because sun astrology has become so like memeified.
Oh,
But
for sure.
yeah, but I'm curious if like you before you got into astrology, like what was your interaction with astrology, and did you identify as a like a Sagittarius sun? I guess I'm asking this because like when I was finishing up my moon series, I was like, okay, well, the sun series is the logical next step, but I feel like I need to, because sun signs are so like pop astrology and mainstream, like I kind of want to like probe into that a little bit and also like reimagine the importance of the sun, or kind of explore that because it is like the center of our system. So anyway, I'm just curious to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, so on my relationship to my sun sign before I got into astrology, I guess when I was a kid, I had the attitude that a lot of kids have. If they really like the image of their sun sign, they'll claim it and identify with it. And I think Sagittarius is always depicted in a really like badass way, where it's usually like these oil paintings of centaurs, like they're super ripped, they're shooting arrows, they're galloping off in a blaze of fire. And it's like, oh yeah, that's badass, I'll claim it. But I guess when I started looking at the significations that you'd find in pop astrology, I wasn't that impressed because I'd think, Well, yeah, who doesn't love freedom, or like who doesn't love to travel? You know, they felt very broad and could apply to anyone, and therefore the very personal nature you find in natal astrology and I don't want to say real astrology, but I yeah, real astrology, you know, it gets far more specific.
Right. Cool. Yeah, so now that you've like been a student of astrology for a number of years, what do you think of like what do you think of sun sign astrology, or like, you know, more broadly, like how does the sun fit into that complex system that is natal astrology or a birth chart? And you know, what does the sun mean to you astrologically?
Yeah, what do I think of the sun and pop astrology? Well, I think it's interesting that there's such an emphasis on the sun, because, well, it's the most predictable in its motion, so that's what we're going to be able to commodify the easiest, and that's what we're going to be able to identify the easiest. But it's interesting that in the kind of society we live in, especially in the West, there is such a focus on the significations of the sun naturally, of, you know, these kings or leaders, or, you know, centrality around the self or your own individual goals. And I do think the sun represents those things, but it's interesting that when we're commodifying astrology, those things are completely central. It's who am I? What is my individual identity away from everybody else? What am I here to do? What's my purpose? And I think, you know, within more capitalistic structures, those ideas are at the forefront.
Yeah, it's interesting the rise of modern astrology within the kind of rise and proliferation of capitalism, because this emphasis of modern astrology on the self and the psychology, the personal psychology, it is very atomizing. And it perhaps like isolating, because it's like, where are other people? I mean, obviously, I'm sure that they're somewhere, but like, where are other people within, you know, the chart is the interior landscape that modern astrology kind of presents. Whereas in a more, I don't like the word traditional, because I'm just like, what tradition are we talking about? But within pre-modern forms of astrology, like the chart represented the entire life, which included the siblings and the parents and the friends and the community and all these things. So yeah, it is really interesting that the focus on the sun. And the other thing that came to mind, I don't know if this is a part of the vernacular where you are, but recently people refer to other people as like king a lot more, which is something that like as a student of political science, or like you know, studied global studies in undergrad, I'm like kingdom is a bad form of government. Like we shouldn't be kind of referring to each other. Like I prefer comrade almost, like, which maybe reveals some of my political leanings a little bit too much, but I'm kind of like, you know, go off, do whatever you want to do, but don't we understand that like kingdom is actually a quite bad form of government, and that most of us would not benefit from it in any way, shape, or form?
I'm right there with you. Comrade is way better than king, but I guess I'm thinking about this from the point of view of somebody who lives next to a country that has a monarchy, and I was thinking about
Yeah,
sun sign astrology.
we were talking before we started recording about like colonial history in Ireland, and it's a very sensitive topic in Ireland.
Well, you know, get any Irish person drunk abroad, they will just start talking about the famine. But I did want to give you kudos for telling like weird racists on Twitter where to go when they're saying that only a small few Irish people have a problem with calling it the British Isles. But the point I was going to get round to before I started tangenting was, I was thinking about the royal family, and that I was thinking about sun sign astrology, and also the sun is relating to the ninth house of publishing and how some of the first astrological content in newspapers was not horoscopes, but a guy writing up predictions for Princess Margaret
Oh,
back when
wow.
she was born and like what would occur in her life. I don't know if he got any of it right, but that's one of like the first I think astrological pieces in a British newspaper. And I think
Interesting.
that same guy was asked to write horoscopes after that. I could be butchering that history. Somebody correct me.
And w approximately when was that around?
Let's see. When would Princess Margaret have been born? Like early 1900s, maybe?
Okay, that makes sense. Cool. Yeah,
Yeah,
any
that.
it I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say that would be an interesting chart to look at in terms of, yeah, imagine there's some Venus Saturn stuff going on there. It's just because of the divorce laws, she was forbidden to marry someone who she actually wanted to.
Interesting.
And then, like, later on in the royal family, they permitted people to divorce.
Very
So, yeah.
interesting. Yeah, which is kind of famously what was going on with Princess Diana and whoever she married. I don't even know, but she was going through a divorce around the time that she died, correct?
Well, they had divorced 5 years, and then she was seen in the papers with some rich guy called Dodi Al-Fayed, and then soon after that, the car accident happened. I'm not a fan of the royal family. I just really like the crown. So yeah.
Yeah, me and you both. I'm not a huge fan of the royal family. Cool.
Good.
Any additional thoughts on the sun and how we can kind of like recontextualize the sun in contemporary astrology away from the kind of commodification, or the like overly psychologized notion that, pop astrology presents.
Yeah, I think we can look at the sun on a personal level because it definitely does have that thing of centrality and it being very core to who we are. And yeah, I guess one of the things I like about the sun is expression or the creative act. So, like being able to do the things that allow you to sing the authentic song of your soul, or it's just to be able to conceive of something and project that out into the world. Because I think one of the main keywords I use for the sun is vision. So that's illuminating ideas, that's seeing the world around you, but it's also that inner illumination of conceiving of ideas and then trying to bring them into the physical world.
Like that kind of creative spark or vital spark inside, which I think is why the sun gets associated with like the lot of spirit, which is the sun's lot, and the soul in general. The sun can tell us something about like the soul of the native. Yeah, I explored this a little bit on the last episode with EY Washington, but I'm just generally curious about exploring this idea because I do think the kind of personal planets of the sun and Mercury and Venus do play this interesting role. Because Mercury and Venus kind of, all the planets revolve around the sun, but Mercury and Venus are dependent upon the sun's motion for like where they can go. They can only move a certain number of degrees away from the sun. So I think Mercury can be one sign away and Venus can be two signs away because Venus can go a little further than Mercury. And Mercury often, if the sun represents thought, Mercury can often represent communication and Venus can represent like values and ideas around beauty and perhaps like artistic expression as well. And so I'm just curious if anything comes up for you, given that you kind of mentioned the sun and creativity or the sun and artistry, if you kind of have any thoughts about the relationship of those planets.
Yeah, so yeah, I definitely think like Mercury and Venus can be tools for that, the raw intelligence of the sun to help express it in the real world. And I remember in Austin Coppock's course, he was using the god Apollo as an example. He's a god of the sun, and he was gifted a lyre by Hermes, by Mercury. So being given this tool that he could express that, inner spark of creativity that requires like skill and learning and that mercurial precision to play an instrument well and skillfully.
Cool. Yeah, it reminds me of that painting that I think Jason Holly talks about in the sun lecture that he did at Norwalk a few years ago, which he kind of like makes fun of a little bit, but it's Apollo surrounded by the muses, like as if they would like dote on him or something. And it's interesting to think about the sun god Apollo's relationship to the muses, because they're supposed to have a close relationship. And I don't have a clear kind of thought there, but
Oh, I have a tangent if you want it.
yeah, please.
Yeah, so I don't know if you use asteroids that much.
Not that much, no.
I use them sparingly, not as much as I used to, but I would always pull up the asteroids for the muses in a chart, and I
Oh,
think they
cool.
can be really informative if they're close to a planet or an angle. They can really tell you about what a person is drawn to in terms of their artistry or their study. And I have the asteroid of comedy, Thalia, and the asteroid Urania, which is associated with this study of astrology, right on my moon. So, that
Oh, wow.
feels very bang on to me. So yeah, I thought I'd bring in some asteroids as a tangent there, just as I heard them, because I do love using them in the way that people like Dimitra George or, oh, why is the name gone out of my head? Michael J. Morse teach them in like a traditional context.
Cool. Very cool. Yeah, I think Michael had a lecture. I don't know, some kind of lectures coming to mind. I'll have to look for it and link it in the show notes.
They
But
had a
seems very
lecture
interesting.
on using the asteroids that appear in the Orphic hymns in the chart.
There we go. Yeah,
Yeah,
seemed
that's
very
a great one.
interesting.
It's
Nice.
available on their website. I'd recommend it.
Cool. Yeah, speaking again of asteroids and centaur, well, I don't know if asteroids or centaurs are considered asteroids, because there's a whole like group of centaurs that people look at as well and work with. But Sagittarius is a cent, the image of it is a centaur, and I'm curious what that sign means to you, and if you like have any myths that come to mind. Obviously, you brought up Chiron
Oh, I
as
certainly
well.
do.
Yeah, or just like, I think myths can be stories as well, like film, just kind of like cultural images that we have, that kind of speak to that place or that sign.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, I'll see if any films come to mind,
Okay.
because, yeah, that. Well, there's that kind of like common trope of that Sagittarian figure of somebody who's very well educated, but is kind of like down and out and kind of like vomiting all over their suit while drunk. I think that was a metaphor that Adam Mellenboss gave in a lecture once, but that kind of stuck with me of, yeah, somebody who is a little bit hedonistic, but kind of profound at the same time. But yeah, to get into, yeah, starting with like the meaning of Sagittarius. Yeah, so let's just be simple about it. So it's a masculine mutable fire sign. So it's going out and doing things, being very active, but seeking to change things in some way. And the image is interesting because it's a centaur, so it's half man, and then half animal. So there's that really like wild animalistic side to Sagittarius, and then there's that very principled and rational human part of Sagittarius as well. And I think Austin Coppock had a good metaphor for Sagittarius. It's like making something out of two things. So like that mutable fire is like a soldering iron. So you're combining two things together that are maybe like completely contrary, and then seeing what they do when they're combined. And I think I went in a very Mercury and Sag roundabout way of getting to all of those in a very disconnected way, but I hope that made sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And one thing that comes to mind, because I think we can think of, like, not to sound judgmental, but I think we can kind of have a speciesist orientation towards the humane versus the bestial, or like human versus animal. But you bringing up Austin reminded me of his work on the decans, and the first decan of Sagittarius is called the Poison Arrow. And the part of Sagittarius, so the first half of Sagittarius is what's called like humane, of the human part, and then the second half is the bestial part. But it's interesting that the first decan is associated with the poison arrow, because the beast does not shoot the arrow, the human shoots the arrow. And I think that there's something poignant about that. And maybe it's like my own planets there, that my own personal planets there. I have the moon and Mars there. But I just think about the destruction. It's like, I don't know how, if I can if phrase this well, but I think there's a ability for people to rationalize their own behaviors and cast judgment on others while doing the thing that it, is destructive or damaging.
Oh, for sure.
So that's just something that comes to mind and feels thought-provoking for me in the moment.
Yeah, that's really interesting what you're saying about the humane part being the one that shoots arrows and tries to, herd or domesticate nature in some way, and that being the human part. So I guess I was thinking that like a lot of the signs adjacent to Sagittarius are very wild, like Scorpio and Capricorn are also quite wild, and there are those autumn signs which are all about the real, like cold, hard physical world and those hard conditions. And I guess there is that kind of like more human part in the middle that's trying to bring some order to that chaos, and maybe in that very masculine way, trying to shape it itself in some way. So trying to do the very human thing of domesticating nature through some level of destruction.
Yeah, and I just wanted to touch on your use of the word masculine, and I just want to get a sense of, like, there have been a lot of conversations around astrology and signs and gender, and I just wanted to get a sense of, like, what you mean when you're referring to masculine or feminine.
Yeah,
Yeah, can you
I should
elaborate on
maybe,
that?
I use that a little bit mindlessly, and I know that we should be very careful when making these distinctions. Yeah, other words for that could be active or passive, yin or yang. But yeah, I guess that kind of masculine impulse is to go out and do things, actively pursue, and then that more yin, feminine, nocturnal mode of being is to let things be, or to let things just flow naturally or come to you and be less like dominating of that environment. But yeah, I do realize that those gendered terms have a lot of baggage. So when I say them, I don't mean in the kind of very prescriptive way we usually use those words. So,
Yeah.
yeah, thank you for flagging that.
No, thank you for clarifying. I don't say that with any judgment. I just wanted to kind of understand how you think about it. Because perhaps there is, I think a lot of people have come up with, like, diurnal or nocturnal, or extroverted or introverted, because if we think about the gender, there is a kind of association with the fire elements and the air elements, with quote unquote the masculine and the diurnal. and the water and earth with the feminine or the nocturnal. And then, you know, if you think about the nature of fire, fire wants to expand, fire wants to move up. If you think about the nature of water, water moves to its own level, you know, water moves with gravity and goes down. So I've come to like kind of think about it in relation to the elements more than anything. But yeah, thanks for clarifying that.
Yeah. So yeah, nocturnal and diurnal are the distinctions I've come to use most often. But yeah, I just imagine people are more used to hearing masculine, feminine. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's good to have these conversations and go, oh, we could change the vocabulary within the community eventually.
Mm-hmm.
But I think putting anything in a binary, it's hard to agree on what the terms of that binary are.
Right.
So we kind of get into using very simplistic language as a result of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I think that's generally the problem of language in general, like things have to mean things.
Yeah.
But then there is also, yeah, that the mercurial nature of astrology comes in, where it's like things have double meanings or things have complicated meanings.
Yeah, and as a Mercury and Sagittarius native, I really vibe with that of words meaning everything and nothing. So kind of that nihilistic approach to, oh, it's just words, they don't mean anything. Or if I see words being used in the wrong way, I'm like, words have meaning and they're really loaded. Yeah. So, yeah.
This is totally a tangent that like maybe we aren't going to go off on, but it reminds me of the Belgium. We were talking about Belgium, I think, before we started recording, and it reminds me of the Belgian artist René Magritte and his work on semiotics, where he like, you know, what is it? Ce n'est pas une pipe. Like, this isn't a pipe in French, and it's a picture of a pipe. And that's the most famous example, but he has all of these. I went to the Magritte Museum when I was in Brussels, and he has like all of these works about like semiotics, where it's like a horse talking about Sagittarius, and it's like, but it has a different word under it. And it's just kind of pointing to this idea that words don't have inherent meanings, and that we kind of like fabricate language, and language is limited.
I actually have been to that exhibit.
Oh, have you?
Yeah, I'd love to know if Magritte has any Sagittarius placements. Yeah, he's probably really mutable. Okay, I'm excited.
Yeah, he has a lot. He has a lot of Sag placements.
Of course.
Okay, so let's share screen.
Is he Mercury or Venus?
He has a Sag. So this was a double A birth time. Way. So yeah, this is very, very reliable. He has a Pisces moon. And then he has the ascendant at early Sagittarius, one Sagittarius, Chiron at two, Uranus at three, Saturn at 12, Venus at 15, Mercury at 16 Sagittarius. So he has an incredibly Sagittarian birth chart.
That is such a stellium. Of course. Yeah.
Yeah.
He could not have it.
I know. Yeah. Yeah.
And I love that as an astrologer, you think, oh, this person probably has this chart. And then you think, oh, that you couldn't possibly be that spot on. And then, nope, first house, Sagittarius stellium. There we go.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. And it's interesting because before I was an astrologer, I loved René Magritte, and we have some interesting synastry going on with our charts, with me as a Sag rising as well. So it's cool how, you know, you get to see those things as well, where you're like, oh yeah, this totally makes sense why I like this person's art a lot, or, you know, why I think they're an interesting character.
Yeah. I love having synastry with artists you're really into or artists you're really affected by. I learned recently that Sinead O'Connor's Venus is exactly conjunct my sun, and I'm like, oh, wait, right, that's why her whole life story is so affecting.
Wow, that's wild. And the interesting thing, yeah, that is really, really interesting, especially like as a person of a certain, again, as a person of a certain politics, I've always been interested in, I always like kind of admired Sinead O'Connor, but
Yeah, she was amazing.
I think as an Irish American, maybe I have a little bit of a different perspective on her than you do.
Yeah, I'd be interested to get into it a little, but she did some absolutely ballsy stuff and was always on the right side of like so many issues. Did some very cool things, even in her later life, like gave up all of her makeup and just donated it to trans women. So, yeah. She was real as hell. Yeah, that's a chart I really love.
Yeah. So this one, unlike Rene Magritte, where we have a double A, this is a C-rated chart, so it's not a very good, not a very good you know, we have to take this
Yeah.
with a caveat, but again, she's, go ahead.
Yeah, I was gonna say not quite as reliable, but it does make sense that she would have Jupiter in the ninth, but also the ruler of the ninth in the first house because she was deeply religious, but in a very like Sagittarius rising way, went through multiple religions throughout her lifetime. I forget the kind of Christianity she eventually became a priest in. She was very religious as a young child, was raised in a religious institution in her younger years, which feels very Saturn in Pisces in the fourth house.
Well, she was like in a seminary basically as a child.
Yeah, I think so. And
Wow.
then converting to Islam later in her life as well. So those ninth house topics of religion and politics being so core to her own expression, and of course going on Saturday Night Live and
Oh my
ripping up the
God.
picture of the Pope to highlight the crimes of the Catholic Church at the time was just, yeah, coolest
Yeah,
lady.
getting chills right now thinking about that video. For listeners, 5 degrees Sag rising, if this birth time is accurate, which would put Mars and Libra on a 5 degree Libra midheaven, which feels very going on Saturday Night Live and ripping up a picture of the Pope while you're singing a song.
Yeah.
Yeah, she just also feels like very, you know, Jupiter and Leo ruling, like chart ruler, Sag rising, Jupiter in a fire sign. It feels very Jupiter in a fire sign to me.
And also that mutual reception between the Sun and Jupiter, strengthening that even more.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, interesting. It would be interesting to get a more accurate birth time to see if that ascendant moves a little later if she's a day chart. Because the sun's at 15 Sag, if she's a day chart or a night chart. But yeah, really, really interesting chart. I love that we're like, I was pretty sure Rene Magritte was a Sag, but I wasn't positive that that Sinead was. So it's really cool that we're getting some good Sag sun examples here.
Yeah, she's also a nocturnal Sag, if this chart is correct. Although that could change within the hour. But yeah, I imagine if an Irish person born during that time has any notion of what their birth time is, and 7:37 is pretty
It's pretty,
like
yeah,
pretty specific.
not rounded.
I would say that that's probably close enough. Yeah, I had my own birth time checked recently when I got my birth records, and yeah, if it's specific and your mother is sure enough, I say believe that, because it
Did
was
anything,
exactly,
yeah, did anything
no,
change with your birth time?
it was exactly to the minute the same.
Oh wow. Yeah,
So
I got my birth certificate last year too, and my mom was off by like 22 minutes, which didn't change a
oh
lot,
wow.
but it did, it changed the rising sign by about 5 degrees. But
Did
yeah,
it change any of your lots?
that's a good question. I'm not sure. I think it changed. I don't think it changed my lot significantly because I think it changed my lot of fortune from like 18 cap to 23.
Oh,
So
okay. It's pretty good.
it made, I have Mercury at 23 cap, so it made the Lot of Fortune like very conjunct Mercury rather than just kind of conjunct Mercury. So little things like that, but not a huge difference.
Oh, I also have the Lot of Fortune conjunct Mercury. And you
yeah,
were doing
I saw
some
that.
research on that about, yeah, wasn't it Rob Hand made some passing comment about people who have Mercury conjunct the Lot of Fortune will make a living as an astrologer at some point in their life, or that's an indication.
Yeah, he said that for any new listeners, you can go back. I did a whole series on like what makes an astrologer, because Rob Hand made this offhand comment, but kind of forceful comment about Project Hindsight, and which was a kind of research project in the astrological community in, you know, starting in the 1990s in the United States. And they found that a lot of people there had Mercury conjunct the Lot of Fortune, or 11th from Mercury 11th from the Lot of Fortune, or ruling that place, or ruling the Lot of Fortune. So there are a lot of criteria that could be met. But yeah, it is really interesting. And it's cool too, because you're the second guest I've had for the Sun series who had this. I had Sam Reynolds on, and he was actually an example that we used in that research, because he has a publicly available chart and has been a professional astrologer for a long time. And one thing I often like to remember and kind of talk about with other people that have this is that what they don't tell you about the Mercury conjunct the Lot of Fortune is that because of the way the Lot of Necessity is calculated, it necessitates the Lot of Necessity, which is like not the funnest lot being on your ascendant, because you calculate the Lot of Necessity Mercury from the Lot of Fortune. So if they're on top of each other, yeah, it's on top of your ascendant, which I found to be like almost like a condemnation of individuality, like condemned to be yourself, like, or else kind of. I don't know if you have any experiences that come to mind,
but... yeah, so being condemned for individuality, or
yeah, I almost feel like I'm like,
yeah,
I have to be myself, like I have to do the thing that feels authentic, or like I'll face the consequences for it. Like there's not a lot of margin of error for me. You know, it just doesn't feel like if I choose those other things that are not authentic to me, I will find happiness, if that makes sense.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. And I feel that intensely of if I'm not doing something that's like very authentic or somewhat individualized, it does feel like some part of you is dying or wasting away. And I used to attribute the fact that I did an awful lot of unconventional or weird things or made weird art and did that publicly to having my chart ruler being Venus out of bounds, because planets that are out of bounds operate in ways that are weird or contrary to social convention. And also having Venus in Capricorn, it being very tied into social convention and being tied into like very conventional ways of behaving, and especially with Venus, socializing, expressing, making art. So yeah, I never really thought of too much about the necessity part of that, but yeah, definitely it feels like I have to do this anyway. I'm doing things that are obscure or tabooed in some way, like comedy or astrology. So I'm going to be in obscurity anyway. I might as well just be out there doing it, or just continue to be obscure. Yeah. It's be a public weirdo or be a hermit weirdo. Those seem to be the two options.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like, yeah, it's like, I relate to that a lot, you know? It's like, okay, I'm going to feel this way. I might as well feel good about my choices if this is how it's going to kind of be.
And can I ask you a question about what it's been like since you've been public about doing astrology? Because
That's
that
a
can
good
be
question. I mean, I
quite a big
think,
thing to be public about in certain contexts.
totally. I mean, I'm not, I guess to be frank or to be transparent, I'm not public in some ways. Like I use a pseudonym, like I use a nom de guerre so that I can have a little bit of distance between like my life and doing public work. And it's not completely like I don't have a completely made up name. Like it's my initials, but it's not SP is not my first name. And Hall is like an abbreviation of my last name. So I do that because, you know, I'm reminded of, and I mentioned this on the podcast in the past, the Oscar Wilde quote, to paraphrase, it's like, man is most free to be himself when he wears a mask. And so there's an element of like creating a little distance to give me the opportunity to do it. And I think that I needed that because I personally have had some sun issues in my life. And I think, you know, my sun is in the second whole sign house, like away from my ascendant. I was born kind of close to maybe a half an hour from sunrise. So when I was born, it was like tech, it was like this kind of dawn time, but the sun is like, you know, technically in the second whole sign house, averse from the ascendant. And so I found in my own life that it can be very hard to allow myself to shine. It can feel very, very uncomfortable. And perhaps that has to do as well with my MC being in Libra, and so being in the sign of the sun's fall, and the sun kind of making a square to that. I don't, you know, there's like a number of things I can kind of point to with that. So yeah, like doing, you know, my partner at the time witnessed like how emotionally difficult it was for me to do the introductory episode for this podcast. And it was very, very difficult to put myself out there. And I've gotten a lot more comfortable with it as I've been doing it. But yeah, I do acknowledge that in some ways, like I keep a bit of a distance, at least, you know, mentally or through this kind of like construct of like having a slightly different, not persona, but you know, just a little bit of a barrier, you know. And to kind of elaborate on that a little bit, like I moved back home recently and I'm open about, you know, maybe this speaks a little bit to my relationship with my family, but like I mentioned before this recording to my mom, like, oh yeah, I have to record a podcast episode. She doesn't know what my podcast is about. She hasn't asked. And
Interesting.
so like I'm not like telling all my immediate family like, oh, I have an astrology podcast. And so yeah, it's but again, I would tell them if they asked, but they haven't asked. And you know, that's part of, I guess, my thing as well. Which feels kind of Capricorn Sun too, but maybe we'll talk about that next month when we're in Capricorn season.
Yeah, for sure. Setting up some of those boundaries or trying to, yeah, be aware of the attitudes towards these things and trying to operate within those conventions. And maybe there are some things to withhold. And I'm currently going through that dilemma of I'm launching an astrology website this weekend because there
Oh,
is a good
cool.
election. And I've been really toying with the idea of hiding behind a pseudonym. I'm already quite public about being into astrology and being into woo. But yeah, I just wonder if I'm doing other kinds of work, whether it be comedy or writing related, if I'm seen to be an astrologer publicly, or if you Google my name and the first thing that comes up is Fionn Cleary Astrology, will that lose me some opportunities? So it is this very interesting point in history where astrology is becoming more accepted. It's becoming a cool thing that most people have some kind of literacy about, but there's still those old attitudes of, oh, this is not a serious or a real thing, and anyone doing it is misguided or a charlatan in some way. And even if you're practicing in a way that's really grounded in ethics, you do have to own the fact that, oh, this is heresy. This is complete absurd ideas, like stating that, oh, yeah, life is inherently meaningful, or there is some kind of like fatedness or some predictive quality to the human life that we can observe through these cycles. And that might be too much for some people. And that's okay. And maybe astrology belongs on the fringes and flourishes in obscurity. Who knows?
Yeah, perhaps. Like, yeah, I mean, maybe there is an esoteric element to astrology, or ought to be, where it's better that it's a little bit misunderstood. But I don't know. Like, I don't feel like I have the right to say, you know, and there are people who very much want to make astrology mainstream and make it understood. And there are people who also don't want that, want to kind of hide the art or protect the art in a way that, you know, perhaps remain keeps it in obscurity. I don't necessarily know the correct answer.
Yeah, I think there's two ends of the spectrum. There's the guy on Twitter who will be tweeting all of these ancient texts and has like this great information, never reveals his name or his face. And then you have somebody like Walter Mercado who's covered in glitter and talking about astrology and just being out there and shining in like the most visible way. We need a new Walter Mercado at some point. There's going to be. It's kind of like in Buffy. In every generation, there's a Walter Mercado.
Amazing. First Buffy reference on the podcast. I'm so happy.
Oh, really? Like 39 episodes in, that's the first one?
Yeah, somehow. I don't know. That's incredible. Who will be the next Walter Mercado? I don't know. Could
That'll
be
be a good
you.
reality TV show. It's just get like all these TikTok kids. Try them on in capes, give them a bit of Botox.
Yeah. What shade of glitter do you use? I don't really know that much about Walter Mercado, actually. It's funny because I hope that this friend doesn't mind me saying this, but they were talking about how like their mom is kind of poo-pooing on them for liking astrology and all of this stuff, but like they watched Walter Mercado in their household with their mom when they were a kid, and so there's like a little bit of like you know, like a juxtaposition of that. Like, I don't understand why we did that, but it's like it's against the church now and blah 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 and all these things. Yeah, interesting.
I obviously discovered him much later in my life because I think he was only a thing in the Spanish speaking world. He was like this huge thing that everybody knew about over in that part of the world, but like people in the West didn't know about him as much. But he was huge and like was able to be public as an astrologer and be publicly presenting as this super camp guy. He never revealed anything about his sexuality or his gender because he was really unsafe to at that time. But yeah, that was just a figure that was able to be so many things that were really difficult to be public about at that time. So yeah, that's just one of my favorite things is introducing people to Walter Mercado. So there's another tangent about famous people.
Yeah. So to move a little bit into the sun in Sagittarius, I'm curious, you know, I talked about like my sun in Capricorn and the aversion to the ascendant. But you have your sun in Sag in pretty close sextile to your ascendant. Do you feel like it's easier for you to kind of shine in the world with that sun in a fire sign, in aspect to the ascendant, or, you know, with like with your moon in fall trying, you know, ruling your midheaven, do you feel like it's more, you know, there's a difficulty there as well for you to kind of
yeah, be public? There is some difficulties, and like there's some difficulties and there's some ease. Like, I've gotten some opportunities to be very public throughout my life, and then there's been some issues, mostly around health. A couple of years ago, I found out I had had chronic Lyme disease for many years, and was just like very sick. It's still like an ongoing thing. I'm not as like down and out with it as I was, but that has informed my life path so much, of being chronically ill and trying to pursue things while being at a very reduced capacity. And I didn't even consider the sextile to the sun as much as they're that lending a little bit of an ease of getting those solar qualities back into the life path. But my sun is in the term and decan of Saturn. So Saturn is a planet of limitations and burdens, and the third decan of Sagittarius is represented by the Ten of Wands in the tarot, and that's this card of a guy absolutely crippled by the weight of 10 huge staffs that he's trying to bring somewhere, so bringing to completion a creative act, but while you are like very much physically burdened. So I do relate that to the myth of Chiron as well, of trying to live your life how you want to live it while having some kind of an incurable wound or like an ongoing chronic issue in your life.
Yeah, and to go back to Austin Coppock and the imagery of the decans, that third decan of Sagittarius, in addition to being associated with the Ten of Wands and like the burdens that we witness there, is also, I believe, Austin Coppock calls it the dead horse. And so it's like just the image that comes to mind is like the skeleton of a horse being covered by the winds blowing the desert, you know, like this idea of desolation that I think speaks to Saturn's rulership. So maybe there's a glimmer of hope in there somewhere, but generally a pretty desolate place, which is interesting given the optimism. You know, we talked about the poison arrow in the first decan and the dead horse in the third decan, and Sagittarius's general association with optimism and buoyancy that comes from Jupiter perhaps. But these kind of dark images in the decans.
Yeah, and even beyond the decans, like Sagittarius is tucked between these malefic ruled signs. So it is really like finding that hope and that foolish optimism amid some pretty rough circumstances, or in an environment where things are like decaying or getting a little darker. And yeah, I guess it's like trying to light a match in the cold to try and get some warmth, and or to try illuminate something for only like a couple of seconds and get a glimpse of it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting because obviously Christmas is in Capricorn season, and we associate that time like the festival of lights, quote unquote. But that last decan of Sag, at 0 degrees Capricorn, the winter solstice is the shortest day of the year. So the sun is at its like nadir in terms of how long it's out in the day. And so, but after that 0-0 kind of point of the winter solstice, the sun starts increasing in light. Each day gets longer. And so perhaps the associations with death, with the end of Sagittarius, have to do with the sun in the last moments of its waning toward its kind of quote unquote, you know, like lowest point of, you know, the least amount of light, the shortest day of the year. And then Capricorn is kind of, you know, again, the festival of lights, the light in the dark. It's actually quite hopeful because it's the birth of something, the rebirth of something that's growing, that's, you know, waning. And even though it's like fledgling, even though it's small, there is this promise of that point opposite toward, you know, the opposite point of zero Capricorn is zero Cancer, where it's the longest day of the year and the sun is, you know, kind of have at not at peak power, but, you know, the sun is, you know, we associate Antitia points with equal power. And so light gets associated kind of with power as well.
Yeah. And I think the fact that Sagittarius is transitioning into the regrowth of the light, it and its association with the Ten of Wands, it really is trudging towards the finish line, because you can see things getting better, even in that Saturnian environment of, you know, having to knuckle down and do the really hard work or just survive. You can see what the end goal is. And I think Austin Coppock in 36 Faces, to paraphrase, said something to that effect of, you know, people with the sun in Sagittarius tree are carrying heavy burdens, but do have that hope and optimism that it will work out eventually, or there is somewhere to put those staffs down that is worth it. So that really hard completion of the creative act, where you might start off with like this really quick spark of hope, and then you carry on that idea, and then in that creative process there's a part where it gets hard and you could ditch that idea, like in the Nine of Wands, where there might be a moment of surrender where you're ready to throw those staves down. Then you get to the Ten of Wands, where it's like, okay, my back is literally breaking, but I see the completion. And I definitely have that in my own creative processes. And I also thought of this because Sagittarius is so changeable. And if the sun is what our central focus is on, people with the sun in Sagittarius can change what they want to do right as they're finishing something. So they're like, okay, gotta finish this project, I've lost all excitement for it, that thing over there, I want to do that.
And do you have that experience?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. When I was doing my solo show this year, there was a point where I was like, man, I wish I was just doing astrology. That's way more easy, because it's not like the thing I have to do, it's a thing I could do.
Right.
And I do think that kind of like changeable nature of Sagittarius, or like that really indulgent way that Jupiter just fulfills whatever we want immediately, could be that as well.
Yeah, I relate to that as well, as someone with their ascendant in the last decan of Sag. So yeah, again, that those kinds of associations with, you know, maybe the kind of overlap with what we were talking about with a lot of necessity and the difficulties of the third decan of Sag, it's kind of like, very much relating to that feeling of like, okay, I've done this, now I want to do something else. But it feeling almost burdensome. But I think the important thing to note with that Ten of Wands image is that there's an image of the Ten of Wands where the person is not carrying the wands. The person has just put down the wands because the work is either overwhelming or not worth the effort. And I think the back-breaking labor, the effort, the kind of toil that we see in that card is kind of communicating that what's at the end of that is perhaps worth the effort that's being carried out. So that feels like, I don't know, like a poignant point that comes up in relation to that part of Sagittarius.
Yeah, and I think that real motivating spirit within Sagittarius, which can trudge through that, is the driving force behind it. And that's why, like, the number one signification people give for Sagittarius is that buoyant optimism and that ability to see things in a broad perspective and go, oh, you know, it's bad now, it won't be so bad later. And it's just able to have a really somewhat detached optimism that some people might find annoying if they're in more fixed signs where it's like, oh no, this is the time for suffering. No more optimism, Sagittarius.
Right. And you're like, no, but this too shall pass. Like, the suffering's going to go. And then people will be like, but what about my joy? And you're like, yeah, that's going to pass too. Yeah. And then more suffering will come. And then more joy will come.
It's like, have you ever seen Fleabag?
Oh, of course.
Yeah. So
the best television show of whatever year it came out. It's just perfect television, the first season.
There's a beautiful line in Fleabag where the main character has fallen in love with a priest, which is very Sagittarian, but this might be a spoiler, so skip a few seconds ahead, but she says, I love you. And to that he replies, it'll pass. And there's just some beautiful Venusian reflections in that show. So it's fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that the beautiful thing, I mean, that kind of comes up for me with that is like, if you choose to let it go, it will pass, you know, like you can hold on to something and you can grow it. It might not be the thing that you should grow, you know, like falling in love with a priest and trying to, you know, be with a priest is perhaps, you know, it might result in some suffering. It might not, you know, maybe there are people who start families with priests and
it does happen.
Yeah. Yeah. And are happy and what have you. But if the priest wants to stay in their role and, you know, it might bring some heartache. And so I think the thing is, it will pass if you make the choice to let it pass. It may pass anyway, but
yeah,
sometimes our resistance can create growth that's not necessarily good.
Yeah, and I think that's where Sagittarius is a real correction of Scorpio, or it helps mitigate really holding on to a specific image or a specific thing, because Sagittarius is far less attached and can depart with the image. Or say, I definitely find this in terms of life pursuits, being a Sagittarius sun, I'm willing to let that change every 2 years and not being so fixed about it. Because I think being more mutable, it's like, okay, this doesn't have to be my life path forever. It might change like the wind, or, you know, that Sagittarian arrow I'm shooting at a goalpost. The wind might take it somewhere else and, you know, I'll just follow that. So, yeah, I think Austin had some reflections on some face of Scorpio, maybe the one that the recent Scorpio eclipse was in. Or was that Taurus? Am I butchering it?
The recent...
Yeah, the last eclipse we had.
Oh, the last eclipse was in Taurus.
Okay.
It was in early Taurus, I think, because the North Node's like already in Aries, but yeah.
Yeah, so where the Sun and Mars were when that happened. So yeah, Scorpio tree of being very attached to a specific image and then having to let that form dissolve. So the desire may still be there, but the specific form that it's the real desire behind it can maybe something that's more authentic or a more true expression of what that desire is, rather than being, now it's got to be this, it's got to be this job, it's got to be this person, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the thing or the kind of like phrase that comes to mind, being a very Sagittarian person myself, is like, thinking about Scorpio is like, okay, you've made all these plans. It's like, but the world is a lot more complex than, it's like that John Lennon quote of like, life is what happens when we're busy making other plans, kind of like Scorpio is very strategic. And then it's like, okay, well, there's a million data points moving in all these different directions and all this stuff is happening. And, so I don't know. It's just a thought.
Yeah, and I do have a strong Scorpio placement where my moon is in Scorpio and that's my
Right.
satellite. So yeah, I definitely can understand the contrast between having the moon in Scorpio and being very fixed emotionally, or that Scorpio thing of, oh yeah, it takes a long time to process things or let go. And then there's also this very Sagittarian part of me that's like, oh yeah, this changes like the wind. And also people come in, ambitions come in, they'll all change. And then there's that more inner part that's still very like holding on to specific things.
Yeah, do you find that it's difficult to reconcile maybe what you feel emotionally and where your mind wants to take you? Or yeah, how do you think about that?
Yeah, for sure. I think the Scorpio moon wants to be very rooted deeply into like place, into people, and wants to hold on to things. And then that more intellectual side of Sagittarius has this perspective where, oh no, things are constantly changing, and it's really good and natural that people, things, and ambitions are in a constant flux. But yeah, there's that part of the Scorpio moon that just gets really deeply hooked in and attached. And there is this massive contrast to what I think and what I feel. So there can't, and that can maybe slow down the process of letting go when intellectually I feel I should be galloping beyond these things. So yeah, that's definitely been a thing I've noticed.
Yeah, it's interesting the your desires for relationality that you just talked about with the Scorpio moon, and then the sun in some way, like being in that relational trigon, being in this mutable, changeable sign, having some rulership in, ruling the 11th by domicile and then being the exaltation ruler of the seventh. It's adding the kind of mutable flair into like your one-to-one relationships and like your community relationships, which feels illustrative of like what you're talking about, where like you kind of need to let go in some ways from like the emotional desires sometimes for the kind of relational reality. Does that feel resonant at all?
Oh yeah, for sure. And it's making sure that the kind of relationships or entanglements you're getting into are actually congruent with, where you see your life going or what your values actually are and if they're aligned. And yeah, it's a very, the moon is a very sensitive and quite young part of us that does get hooked in and attached in a way that's beyond the intellect. And I think things like falling in love with people or places or anything we get like deeply rooted and attached in, it's very hard to intellectualize your way out of that. And especially for a Scorpio moon who feels that so deeply and intensely and full bodily. So for sure.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. I feel like what we're talking about in terms of relationality in the sun is like further illustrated by the sun's house placement. And I'm kind of reminded of what we're talking Austin Coppock a lot in this podcast conversation, but what he kind of talks about in relation to the third house, which is like Planets in the third house are like busy doing the things that you need to do on a day-to-day basis to kind of maintain your life. And there's like also this kind of internality of the third house, the internality of like any of the Caden houses, the 12th, the 6th, the 3rd, or the 9th. And there's just an interesting thing that's kind of coming out. You talked about the end of Sagittarius as like, you know, this kind of end of the journey. And you also, similarly to me, have this kind of balsamic moon where the moon is moving towards the new moon. And there's kind of an internal quality to that as well. And so if anything comes up with those, the kind of internality and the moon phase and the relation to the end of Sag, I'd love to hear that. But I think more so than anything, just like, how does the sun in this third house, like how do you feel like that plays out for you and adds flavor to your experience?
Yeah, I definitely had some thoughts about the sun and the third. I will say, just before I get into that, yeah, that balsamic moon phase is interesting, and I do think it really gives me a very internalized attitude of, oh, all things will end, or like there's a very deeply ingrained understanding of impermanence. And and especially being in Scorpio, which is so obsessed with debt, I think like even when I was a kid, I was like, oh yeah, that's fine. Or it's just being able to think about that quite fearlessly and naturally, in a way that I saw some adults in my life really struggling with fear of debt, and then it's just me being very chill about it. But
because that was just naturally the kind of landscape that you were dealt in some sense.
Yeah, and I didn't grow up around a lot of debt or anything like that, so I don't know where the comfort came from, but I guess.
I think that with the balsamic moon, there is just this feeling of like, I don't know exactly how to describe it. And I have a little bit of a different flavor because I have the moon in Sag and a fire sign. So there is this kind of like the externality of Sag and then the internality of the moon phase, like the darkness. But there is this feeling of like, oh, we're like moving towards the end of things, you know, like, which I can't quite communicate. It's just an experiential thing of like, this feels like we're towards the end. And that kind of changes the perspective slightly.
Yeah, because it's really difficult to conceive that feeling on like a wider level of what does it mean to be at the end of things? Is this like
the end of what? What are we even?
Yeah. Are we as people representative of generational trends that are coming to an end? Will we be the kind of people that people in like 100 or 200 years are like, oh, they don't make people like that anymore? Because I look at some old photos and I'm like, people don't look or speak like that anymore. And it's like, you get the rare few people who feel like they're from a different time. Maybe that's not the right way to do it. But yeah, especially related to ideas of debt or impermanence or even the world around us, knowing that there's some level to which we are at the end of things and finding our comfort or denial in that.
Wonderful. But yeah, thanks for sharing that.
On the sun in the third house, I definitely see the third house as like your immediate locality, or especially as the moon has its planetary joy in the third house, like that signification of the gathering of masses, which is what I really like. Because I used to just naturally prescribe like theater or stand-up comedy to the third house, and that's something I'm involved in, and that is a thing that can only happen locally and in a gathering of people in person, as opposed to like other third house places like the internet, where we're gathering in a more disembodied, detached way. I don't know where I'd put like film and television and podcasting. Maybe that's more of a ninth house activity. But
yeah, I mean, the Netflix special feels more like the ninth house in terms of stand up, but like going to your local comedy, you know, comedy club feels like a very like third house activity for sure.
Yeah, the Netflix special is that real solar ninth house thing of you're very much exalted there and raised up. Well, the Netflix special doesn't have the weight it used to, but
Right.
definitely it used to be a thing of, oh, if that guy is a Netflix special, he's made it.
It's interesting though, like hearing, again, to go on a little third house, ninth house comedy tangent, it's interesting to hear how comedians prepare for specials, because there's not just the Netflix special, but there's like other kinds of hour specials that the comedians will film, and they'll do that by working out their material on typically like your local scene. Like you
Yeah.
go to the comedy club at 2 a.m. or whatever, and you're just working out your material to kind of build up your hour, which then you take on the road, or you go and film a special, what have you. But you're working it out on the local level. You're not working out your new material necessarily on the road. Maybe that's a misunderstanding, but
No, that's exactly it. And like the third house being these really regular rituals. If you are wanting to be a really good stand-up comedian, you have to be doing it maybe 7 or 8 times a week, or at least like most evenings, if you want to feel really in the zone. And if it's that kind of like club comedy you're doing, because of the pandemic and because of health stuff, I haven't been doing stand-up as regularly. But when I was before the pandemic, it was definitely like this whole life enveloping ritual practice for like 2 months of going to a cafe, very third house thing, doing some writing, then going into a pub and doing stand up. And yeah, also it's a lovely communal activity where half of the fun of it is chatting to people afterwards once you've done your 5 or 10 minutes and enjoying that community aspect. And I guess that connection with the third house and the 11th house with that kind of local community thing as well.
Yeah, I'm just thinking about writing in the third house, and I'm feeling like you think about like writing jokes on napkins. That feels like a very like third house form of writing as well, where you're just like scribbling a note for a joke, like a tag or whatever they call, a punchline. Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, yeah, the sun joy is in the ninth. So what does it mean for the sun to be in this place of opposite its joy? That's not like a debility in any way, but it's definitely a different kind of exaltation or shining in a different place. Yeah, the sun, the ninth is like associated with God and pilgrimage, and the third is associated with like the moon and local temples and like local kind of cults, the religious, that work that you do on a daily basis rather than that event, that journey that you take once in your life kind of thing. And so it's
Yeah.
interesting that the sun in the third.
And there is a very Dionysian culty quality to especially stand-up comedy or the improv world. I don't know if you've ever seen BoJack Horseman. They
Oh, I
made a
love
very
it.
good
Yeah.
argument that improv runs very similar to Scientology. And I endorse that lovingly. But yeah, comedy is very Dionysian. In dark spaces, there's a couple key figures everybody knows. It's mostly centered around alcohol or drugs. And
Yeah,
yeah.
food and spirits flowing,
Exactly.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's very, very Jupiterian in that way, where it's about joviality and humor and oftentimes absurdity. That being another keyword I love for Sagittarius in its opposition to Gemini is taking facts, understanding them deeply, and then like kind of fucking around with them.
Flipping them on their head.
Or yeah, or being, or maybe like in some cases, twisting them for propaganda and it's kind of darker manifestations, but there is just this lovely quality of yeah, wordplay or absurdity or taking something that's generally understood and, as you said, flipping it on its head.
Yeah, there is an association with Jupiter. Or I'm sorry, there's association with Sagittarius, and it's like extreme form as like the zealot, like the religious kind of zealot, the fighter
Oh, yeah.
for, yeah. And I think that comes in with, it's like, how do you win? Like the winning of hearts and minds is so important in winning like an ideological war. And yeah, the zealot, I think, is fighting from a place of religious truth, or yeah, a kind of almost irrational belief in whatever they're fighting for.
Yeah, and I think Sagittarian influenced people cannot get away from having their politics or their religion, even if they are maybe apolitical or atheist, they have strong opinions and they're going to tell you about it. And that being so keyed into the identity. And I think a major thing, and it really fuels Sagittarian people as well to have conviction. And to really value picking a set of ideas and sticking with them, which is weird for a mutable sign to do, but having that really fiery, passionate conviction behind a set of ideas and then trying to spread that fire of conviction to other people.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting. I mean, for Sagittarius risings in particular, but any Sagittarius house, Leo is the ninth from that house. So there is going to be some association with, like worldview, philosophy, religion, and that's a fixed place governed by the sun. And so, yeah, it is interesting. Like the identity of the Sag rising is quite changeable. But that doesn't necessarily mean that the belief system is changing. Like there might be a fundamentally fixed belief system that travels along with this changing identity or changing actions that are
Yeah.
happening.
It's just made me think of the fact that a lot of cult leaders are very Sagittarian influenced. And the fact that if you look at the biographies of cult leaders, they will have gone through a couple belief systems or been involved in a couple organizations before they found the one that they found prominence in and then were able to have a level of influence in. So, like, people who are vying for that solar power are willing to, like, change their face, change their hair, change everything they believe to find that position of power.
Yeah, it's interesting. Sometimes like the dark, I'm reminded of like Libra and Libra's association with dictators, and it's interesting just sometimes
Oh,
like,
yeah.
yeah, like I think Vladimir Putin is Libra. Some type of Libra. The birth info is questionable, but anyway, we're not going to
For
go there,
sure.
but it's
Yeah,
interesting
I
how
will
things come
say
up.
that checks out because he has a lot of like very vain Venusian pictures of himself like riding horses topless. So yeah, only a Libra can do that.
Yeah, I wanted to say yeah, I don't want to get off on this tangent, but yesterday, the former Secretary of State, why is his name eluding me right now? Called like the Butcher of Cambodia.
Oh, Kissinger.
Yeah, Henry
Oh, yeah,
Kissinger.
Happy Kissinger Death Day.
I can't believe that I could not remember Kissinger's name. The nights I've stayed up thinking about the things Kissinger has done, I don't even want to say, but I think he's Gemini
Yeah.
rising, but has Libra placements as well,
Yeah, he
and
has
is
like.
viewed very unfavorably by many people for very good reason.
Yeah, he's a weird one. He has Venus in the 12th house, in Taurus, and apparently, like throughout his life, he's not a good-looking guy, but he was viewed as like a sex symbol, or like he was really popular with girls when he was younger, and he was always just looked like a melted candle. But like, there's just something about that domicile Venus that's doing something for him.
Yeah, okay, so we have a double A rated chart for Kissinger as well. I'm just gonna pull it up really quickly.
Oh, perfect.
Yeah, so he is has this Gemini, stellium, Sun, Mercury, Mars, Gemini ascendant as well. And then he has the moon and Saturn, the exaltation ruler of Libra in the fifth whole sign house. So, and Saturn rules the MC in the ninth whole sign house. So it feels very fitting for a the ninth's association with like the federal government and internationality. He was the former Secretary of State. Saturn associated with constriction, and he was a proponent of realpolitik, so like a kind of very conservative strain of international relations, where very calculating for the kind of interest of the US government, putting the interest of the US government above all, depending no matter the morality of that. Yeah, and then Venus in the 12th in Taurus. So like low key a very kind of Venusian slash Saturnian person in a sense.
Yeah, I was listening to a Behind the Bastards episode about him today, and just learning more about him beyond what I gleaned from the little bit Anthony Bourdain spoke about him. And yeah, I'm just always aware that, oh yeah, that's one of those American political leaders who's just an absolute monster who
Yeah, I
lived
saw that.
forever.
Yeah, he lived to be 100 years old. I saw that Anthony Bourdain clip today where he was like, I would punch Henry Kissinger in the face. Everywhere I go, I see the fruits of his good works, he says sarcastically. So enough about Henry Kissinger, but let's talk about your Jupiter placement and
Oh, yeah.
how that, you feel like that kind of shapes the experience of your son.
Yeah, so I used to struggle a bit to interpret my Jupiter because it's my benefic out of sect. But it is ruling my son, but it's in the sixth house. So it's kind of tucked away in a place that takes away its importance, but it's really dignified otherwise. It's in domicile in Pisces, it's in its own face. So it's got some stuff going for it, but I guess because it's in the sixth house, it might explain why I really gravitate towards mysticism or astrology or systems of belief, but I found it maybe a little bit later in life through becoming sickly and having a lot of time to fall down these rabbit holes and to or having experiences where a little bit of fate or philosophy helps because the sixth house is a house of problem solving and a house of ailments and issues, and I think having Jupiter there brings a little bit of that hope and optimism to those difficult circumstances. But yeah, the sixth is a little bit of a difficult place to name drop Austin again. He once said that Jupiter in the sixth house is a hard place to spread and elevate that like Jupiterian wisdom. It prefers like a big platform like the 11th house where it has everyone around instead of like people in sick beds or your small dogs and animals.
Yeah. But who needs meaning more than, a person on their last legs?
Yeah, and it's like real true meaning because I think an awful lot of spirituality, especially New Age spirituality, doesn't account for real world suffering or illness or a lot of new thought philosophies can't really speak to people who are like chronically ill or like disabled or unhoused. And a lot of that manifestation ideology or these ideas that come out of prosperity Christianity to really find the roots of that, it doesn't really speak to people in those positions. So I think finding truth or wisdom in harder circumstances, if you have your Jupiter somewhat afflicted, I think that might be a manifestation of it.
Yeah, like New Age spirituality will sometimes go as far as to pathologize illness or any kind of, if you don't have enough money, it's your fault.
Yeah, there's some moral failing on your part that you haven't manifested a better life, or in some extreme circumstances, God has chosen his favorite people to be rich and healthy, and or other ideas
Yeah, or
where
you have
people,
somehow chosen this
yeah.
life.
Or when people misunderstand karma or reincarnation, they must assume that anything bad that happens is a result of poor actions in a past life.
Yeah, very interesting. Okay. See where we're at. Before we move on to, I guess we could talk about sun aspects first. I have a kind of additional question, but yeah, are there aspects that your sun makes that you think would be important to discuss or bring up?
Yeah, there's one important one where the sun is squaring Jupiter, so it's in aspect to its ruler. And I do think that really bleeds in and reinforces that Sagittarian stuff of being very idealistic or in some way growth oriented or focused on some kind of personal development, whatever that means to you personally, and those things being quite core to my identity, and also with it being mutable, being able to understand there's ebbs and flows of getting into that swing of going really hard into personal development or philosophical learning, and then parts of your life where you're just living or surviving in some way, and those things take on less importance. But yeah, I'd be curious to know if you have any thoughts on Jupiter squared the sun, because an awful lot of modern interpretations are, big ego or like grandiose ideas of the self.
Well, one thing that comes to mind that I find really interesting about squares between the sun and superior planets in general, so superior planets being Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn, is that when the sun is square any of those planets, which the square is supposed to be of the nature of Mars, it's kind of fast cutting, difficult aspect. The planet that's aspecting the sun is going a kind of average speed. So at the sextile, the planet is going very fast or quite fast. And then when the planet is conjunct the sun, the planet is going very fast, the fastest it's kind of go in, I think, in the cycle. But at that square, and again, the square is associated with fast cutting, that planet is at a normal speed, which is an interesting juxtaposition, it feels like, for me. So I think off the top of my head, yeah, so you have the square, and then you have the sun separating from that square. And so the sun is like well resourced by Jupiter, I would say. Like all of these kind of Sagittarian planets are well resourced by Jupiter, but it is from this place of the sixth, which is, you associate that with illness. It can have associations with subservience as well. And so Jupiter has to bring those things to bear to kind of resource that third house. So, yeah, I tend to think of the squares between any of those mutable squares as kind of the easiest, especially when it's like Sagittarius and Pisces, because they're both ruled by Jupiter. And I can see what people say in terms of the modern thing of like big ego or a kind of expansion. But I don't necessarily tend to look at it in a negative way. I would think of it as the support of big ideas and kind of the faith that comes with Pisces being a kind of support for the action, or the kind of like insight that can come with Sagittarius. So I feel like there's this kind of interplay between faith and insight as well.
Yeah. And I definitely think, Jupiter is really helpful in that way, in that kind of dynamic aspect where it is reinforcing with it is reinforcing the sun with these really universal or multiversal ideas. So if you are in a spot of trouble, there is this inner insight that's saying, well, you know, think of it this way and kind of remove yourself from the situation. There's multiple ways you could go with this. Or a way I think of Sagittarius is, yeah, that kind of like multiversal consciousness of going, well, if you step back a moment while you're making a decision and see which timelines branch off from this decision and kind of try to pre-imagine what those are and then make a decision from there. And I think as the sun as carving out our life path or choosing the storyline in some way, and maybe Jupiter giving you the gift of choice or helping you know which is the most ordered decision to make if there's any choice in it. Yeah, it does help with that. Yeah. Kind of tangented off there.
No, not at all.
But yeah.
I think another interesting thing too that's kind of coming to mind looking at your chart as well is that the moon is transferring the light of Jupiter to the sun within a day of your birth. So your moon is at 10 Scorpio, Jupiter is at 19 Pisces, and the sun is at Jupiter is holding the light and the moon will receive the sun. So the sun's at 22 to Sag. So the last aspect that the sun made was to Jupiter, if I'm looking at this correctly, and I might be looking at it wrong, but that was before your birth. And then shortly after your birth, the moon will trine Jupiter and Jupiter will be holding that light of the sun and will kind of communicate it to your moon. And so there feels like this connection in your chart between like what you think and what you feel being mediated by like the buoyancy of faith in some way, or like the literal feelings in your body. If we think about the sixth house and like challenges of the body. And so I feel like there's something that's being communicated of like the resource of the moon in the second and the internality of the sun in the third. There's like, I think something perhaps like there's an option for you to turn inward and to kind of probe the congruence between how you feel and what you think and like, you know, all those Jupiterian significations are kind of intermediating those things.
Yeah, so. For sure. And I do think that is one of the benefits of having all these combinations in my chart that are so insular and introspective that it's really intense inside there, but it does help you organize your psyche in a way. And whenever I'm projecting ideas out into the world, I can quickly just go, oh, okay, that's a judgment of myself being projected elsewhere. And this is, kind of like, I guess, even ordering external opinions and then going, okay, that's actually informative of the internal. That was a very messy way of articulating that. Maybe I skipped a couple of steps, but yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting too, like not to kind of get off topic, but you also have a similar thing. You know, we talked about like the internality of that moon and the fixity of that moon in contrast to, you know, the hot external quality of your sun. And like, I don't know if you relate to this, but as someone with the with Mars in the first soul sign house, like I need to move every day to like feel okay. And there's some action that I feel like I want to be taking every day. And then you have Venus in the fourth, which is like, you know, if we think about it, and that's home. It's literally your home. Like your ascendant ruler is at home. And you know, we can also think about it as the most internal part. So again, there's also this kind of like tension between this desire to act in a certain way, or the desire for movement, and this kind of internal quality with your Venus. Does that resonate at all?
Yeah, for sure. It's so internal, but it's definitely helpful to, as you said, have those daily practices to externalize the internal. Mm-hmm. And I think that for me presents more creatively than it is like true movement practice. I probably would benefit mm-hmm. from getting back into yoga or qigong or something like that, but definitely when you're so nocturnal or so yin, you do need to get it out some way. So it helps to have mm-hmm. some of those more diurnal expressive planets to help out with that.
And it makes some sense with Mars and Libra, I suppose, for it to manifest as like the creation of art, or the creation of, you know, whatever creative act it may be, because Libra is so associated with creativity and art and what have you. Do you have any good perfection stories? I know we have to wrap up soon, but just curious if anything comes to mind there.
Okay, I'm just gonna scan my mind. Is there any I can tell on the podcast without it being super dark? No.
Okay.
I don't have a perfection story, but I do I think this is a nice note to wrap up on, is we didn't get into the mythology of Chiron too much. And I think that's a nice thing to wrap up on, since that's the star lore associated with Sagittarius.
Wonderful.
I also wrote a whole one-man show about him. So I spent a lot of time with Chiron, and I can get into the timing of doing that show with the asteroid and with some of the other stuff in my chart, which was so ridiculously spot on for doing a show about Chiron. But yeah, I think with everything we talked about, with trudging through to the finish line, or like living your life in a place of survival or some level of hardship, Chiron is such a lovely myth for that, because he was a centaur. He was this great teacher of all the Greek gods and heroes in mythology. He was a healer. He was one of the first astrologers. He was just incredibly wise and educated. And then by a complete freak accident, he gets poisoned by an arrow shot by Heracles. It creates an incurable wound, and Chiron is immortal, so he literally cannot die. So he is just stuck with this predicament. And, you know, he tries to find some kind of stoic acceptance and live life. And I, in my show where I play Chiron, really get into him not accepting it and just being completely bitter and completely resentful of the ineptitudes of the health system. And I pretty much transposed Greek mythology onto rural Ireland and Irish society and the Irish health system to vent my frustrations through that. And I didn't make it like an astrological or a spiritual show, but I did bring in some of those ideas with an exchange with the Oracle of Delphi, who was trying to like tell his future, because he was looking for some insight as to, okay, is this going to be a lifelong thing? Mm-hmm. Am I just stuck in excruciating pain forever? And I chose that myth because, like, as somebody with Lyme disease, which is an incredibly hard thing to treat, and a lot of people will peddle you some really weird ideas about how to treat it, or deny the existence of it entirely, it's just felt like such a good story to kind of transpose my own life onto and explore in a comedic context. And yeah, where Chiron is associated with Sagittarius, when he's finally allowed to die, he becomes the constellation of Sagittarius. So he's immortalized in the stars then. And yeah, I think an awful lot of his myth of being this multifaceted, multi-formed, multi-hyphenate being who is incredibly philosophical and skilled and creative, really, yeah, sings true to a lot of the qualities of Sagittarius.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a beautiful note to end on, I think. Thank you for sharing that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Do you have any, well, I guess, do you have any imparting thoughts about the sun? And if not, where can we find you? And is there anything that you're working on that you'd like to share with us?
Yeah.
Is there a recording of the Chiron one-man show is what I want to know. I would love to see it.
A recording of the Chiron show may surface at some point. I do Wonderful. Have one. I would like to do the show again and get a better performance in. Because on the final night of the 7-night run, the costume broke halfway through.
Oh, no.
So I had to be like, okay, guys, I'm having a little bit of a pain in my back, foreshadowing. We're going to take an intermission. Luckily, that did not break the flow of the show and the audience were still into it.
Uh-huh.
There was also like 30 kids from an all-American Christian college at the show for some reason.
Oh, wow.
So I think, you know, their Jupiterian optimism and fate kind of like bolstered the mood. Uh-huh. So yeah, that was a,
I'll keep my eyes a open
weird
for
detail,
it,
but yeah, so it may emerge. I would like the astrology community to see it, but yeah, it might be sometime in the new year.
Cool. Yeah, I think, you know, with everything going on in the world right now, you know, kind of coming out of the pandemic ongoing, I think reflections on chronic illness are very needed. So I would be really interested to see it.
And what was interesting is some people connected to the show, I learned, were recently chronically ill with long COVID. So even some people I knew just recently becoming chronically ill and having to go on that chironic journey of the uncertainty of how long this wound is going to persist and how do you change the mode in which you live under chronic illness. And it's a, you know, as somebody who knows what that's like, it's a really heartbreaking thing to see. And I think doing a comedy show about something so heavy, was something I really wanted to do. And it was definitely born out of the pandemic.
Feels very like last decan of sun in the last decan of Sag too. It's like kind of making light or like finding levity in something heavy and dark.
Yeah. And I think that's like one of the most common phrases of misery loves comedy or something, something akin to that of comedy is born out of some kind of misery or some kind of like a wild part of us that's touched or is just completely disenfranchised with something and now has something to say from that place. So for sure.
Yeah. Is there anything else that you're working on that you'd like to share with us, and where can we find you?
So you can keep up to date with all of my upcoming creative work at Fionn Cleary on Instagram. That's my main place, as I'm kind of abandoning Twitter or X. And yeah, this weekend I'll be launching what will be called fionnclearyastrology.com. So all of my astrology services and writings will be up there. Awesome. And yeah, I'll just have to see what being more public about being an astrologer is like.
Well, I wish you all the success. Congratulations on launching your website. And Fionn, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It was a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you. Yeah, this was super fun. And I've been loving this project entirely of getting to hear like really well-studied astrologers just talk about their charts on a very personal level. So yeah, love this project.
Really appreciate it. Thank you. To support the show by donating or becoming a member, please visit my website, which is linked in the show notes. And please subscribe to the show wherever you listen. You can also find me on Instagram and Twitter. See those links in the show notes as well. If you have any questions or feedback on the show, please feel free to contact me via my website or email me at sbalhorary@gmail.com. In the show notes, you can also find links to astrologers and resources that we touched on in this episode. Thanks for listening to the show. I'll see you next time.